thank you for the introduction. I love the quote that you read.
I knew that you
because it reminded me about 2 months ago, one of the most conservative justices on our Supreme Court, Antonin Scalia, went to the Federalist Society, which is a conservative society, in Puerto Rico, and said, any liberal justice, anyone who believes in a living constitution, is an idiot. Which kind of puts me in my place, because thanks to Vincent, I've been brought here once again to lecture on a topic that I have really very little association with. He's brought me to talk about religious freedom in the United States, and I talked about animal sacrifice, and I don't sacrifice animals. 11 years ago, I came to talk about sexual re-expression in the United States, from pornotopia to the land of Puritans. So this is an odd topic because I'm not a conservative. So you must take my words such as they are, and I'm willing to stand as Saint Sebastian in questions and answers, and you can throw asparagus at me, whatever you want. I want to emphasize the title of my talk. Title of the talk is The Paradoxes and Crisis of Contemporary Conservatism in Politics and Law. So I'm going to make little, maybe no mention of Edmund Burke's Reflection on the Revolution in France, published in 1790. I want to talk about conservatism in the last 50 years of the United States, and in particular in the last 25 years, from Reagan to King George W. Bush, as I would refer to him in my classes at home. Now, to talk about the paradoxes and then the crisis of contemporary conservatism, I have to define what I mean by conservatism. And I take conservatism to embrace five principal tenets or hallmarks. First, and here I'm thinking about really the origins of contemporary conservatism in the 1950s. I'm thinking about the works of Russell Kirk's Conservative Mind, published in 1953, Clinton Rossiter's Conservatism in America, Michael Oakeshott's Rationalism in Politics, and the writings of William F. Buckley, T.S. Eliot, Irving Kristol. I have to include him. I would say Irving and his son, Bill Kristol. Jean Kirkpatrick, who recently died last week, columnist George Will, just to name a few, as well as in terms of my area of specialization, the law, the late Chief Justice Rehnquist, Robert Bork, and Justices Antonin Scalia and Clarence Thomas. They really inaugurated the post-World War II conservative movement, which I will argue has been transformed in the last 25 years. And maybe conservatism in America is no longer conservative, but simply right-wing. Now, what I mean by conservatism, I said five tenets or hallmarks. Most fundamentally, conservatives are epistemological skeptics. They share a kind of intellectual modesty. In other words, they embrace doubt and distrust reason. This runs, of course, back to Burke, but most notably, of course, in the work of Michael Oakeshott. And it underlies the following reasons. So epistemological skepticism. Second, and related, has been the association with an emphasis upon religion and faith. And faith is always in opposition to reason. Faith is the basis for the control of human behavior and institutions, rather than reason. And that, of course, leads to their opposition to social planning. In the last 25 years, we've seen faith-based groups and initiatives, the role of evangelical Christians in the 1980s, the moral majority in the 1990s, and now groups like James Dobson's Focus on the Family. It's reflected in our political discourse, at least of Republican presidents. Recall Ronald Reagan calling the Soviet Union an evil empire. Not to be outdone, because of course he wants to outdo Ronald Reagan, King George W., referring to the axis of evil, Iraq, Iran, and South Korea, as well as, of course, his faith-based initiatives in support for government to religion. So, faith rather than reason. Third, and also closely related, is, of course, a reliance on tradition, prior practices, habits, and a profound distrust of change, and most certainly a disdain for governmentally sponsored programs of social change, which are derided as social experimentation. Hence conservatives' opposition to the New Deal in the 1930s, the New Frontier in the 1960s, and the Great Society. Fourth, and clearly following from these first three premises, is a profound devotion to limited government and individual self-reliance. And this point has a number of components. Devotion to limited government. Conservatives embrace the idea of separation of powers and federalism, and they trace their intellectual roots to the opponents of my Constitution, the anti-federalists during the founding. That opposition grew, dominated American politics in the late 19th century with the rise of rugged individualism, laissez-faire capitalism. And it reemerged in the 1950s, in the beginning of the new conservative movement, with the profound opposition to the Supreme Court's ruling in Brown versus Board of Education in 1954, which was seen as not only an extravagant use of judicial power, of the federal government's power to try to achieve equality in education, but also intrusion upon principles of federalism, local government, local autonomy. Federalism, I know, in France is a strange concept, to say the least. But this is a profound tenet of American political thought, opposition to the national government. And then, of course, more recently, conservatives have rallied around the banner of Roe versus Wade, which was a decision in 1973, declaring that women have a right to choose. The court's declaration that women have a right to choose under our Constitution to choose an abortion trumps federalism, because individual rights, if you have a national system, always trumps state rights. So this is, again, opposition to federal power, to the role of the courts, and more recently, oh my God, just 2 years ago in Lawrence versus Texas, a conservative court struck down a state law which made homosexual sodomy a crime, not heterosexual sodomy. By the way, sodomy is not defined in the law. It's a rather funny circumstance. I won't go into the details. It's too early in the afternoon, in the evening. So, both separation of powers and federalism were, of course, designed by our founders, James Madison in particular, to make political change difficult and to limit the powers of the national government. So this is an enduring trait of the conservative tradition, and not merely just part of the popular culture, embrace of separation of powers and federalism. Conservatives, especially in the post-World War II period, have also stood in strong opposition coming out of the New Deal to government regulations and embraced laissez-faire capitalism and free markets. They traditionally, that is say the last 50 years, again, I consider these points as part of the devotion to limited government, to believe that the national government should engage in financial self-restraint, not spend this into the poorhouse. And in foreign affairs, in the last 50 years, traditional conservatives have embraced isolationism, although that runs back to the early 20th century, I think, as well, in the refusal to of our Senate to ratify the Versailles Treaty, which is rather surprising. Or you could say, even in World War II, the refusal of the United States to enter World War II until we had Pearl Harbor. Isolationism, non-interventionism in foreign affairs, except when necessary, for example, in the containment of the former Soviet Union. Isolationism is a very strong feature of American culture because America, unlike Europe, has had the luxury of a great geographical expanse separated by two oceans, which has reinforced. So when our minorities, the Mormons or whatever, couldn't get along in upstate New York, they went to the Great Salt Basin in Utah and escaped. So we didn't have the geographical battles and boundary disputes that Western Europe had. We had a huge continent to conquer, separated by two oceans. And only now in the 21st century are we beginning to face the problems of dealing with minorities and immigration that Europe has had to deal with for a long time. And the United States is just beginning to learn how to deal, because in Florida and Southern California, whites are now minorities for the first time because of the influx of Asians and Central and South Americans. And so that will be a big test for the 21st century, and I think a big test for conservatives. Fifth and finally, to talk about something that I know about, contemporary conservatism, has been the opposition to the role of the judiciary, specifically to the Supreme Court's rulings in Brown versus Board of Education, declaring in 1954 that the separate but equal doctrine, separate schools for blacks and whites, was unconstitutional. And then in the 1960s, we always hear about the Warren Court, named after Chief Justice Earl Warren, but it in fact only occurred between 1962 and 1968. It was a blip in American politics that had profound cultural repercussions, because between 62 and 68, the Supreme Court under Earl Warren forged what's called the Due Process Revolution. That is to say, it expanded the guarantees of the Bill of Rights for the rights of the accused, in part to make equality in the criminal justice system a meaningful fact of life. And it forged the so-called one person, one vote, or reapportionment revolution. These were blips about which conservatives since Barry Goldwater in 64 and Richard Nixon in 68 have continuously campaigned against. Of course, then there was the abortion ruling in Roe versus Wade in 73, which angered conservatives even more. And then these recent decisions striking down laws discriminating against homosexuals in the workplace, and sodomy, as I mentioned. So conservatives, part of the culture, has been to attack the judiciary. And this comes from Richard Nixon in 1968, who campaigned against judicial activism and the promise to appoint strict constructionists, those who would only literally interpret the law as though that were a possibility. I always like to quote Ralph Waldo Emerson, who was a transcendentalist, a great late 19th century writer, and he said, "It takes a creative reader as well as a creative writer." Whenever we interpret or read, we impart part of ourselves into the text in taking the meaning out of the text and carrying with us. But Nixon campaigned on strict constructionism, and of course he made four appointments to the court, and they were the ones that handed down Roe versus Wade, which profoundly disillusioned conservatives. So in 1980 and 1984, Ronald Reagan campaigned on a jurisprudence of original intent and vowed to appoint more conservative judges than Nixon had appointed. And a jurisprudence of original intent means you look beyond the text to what the framers had in mind, which of course is reinterpreting what the framers had in mind, because we can't discern what the framers had in mind over 200 years ago. James Madison, who's often called the father of our Constitution, claimed that in fact even the Federalist Papers were not reliable, that the Constitution was not the product of a single mind, but rather multiple people who drafted the Constitution and then in 13 states ratified the Constitution. So this jurisprudence of original intent is a conservative philosophy designed to reinforce federalism, separation of powers, and undermine the expansion of individual rights. Well, notably, King George G.W. Bush vowed in 2004 to name, quote, justices like Scalia and Thomas. Scalia and Thomas are the two most conservative members of the Supreme Court. Scalia was, of course, appointed by Reagan in 1986, and Clarence Thomas was appointed by King George G.W. Bush's father, George H.W. Bush, and is very conservative. Now, I think it's very important to clarify what these terms mean, judicial activism versus judicial self-restraint. Because in Europe, of course, you had no tradition of judicial review until after World War II, really as a result of Hans Kelsen and the creation of constitutional courts. And as a result, your constitutional courts, which exercise judicial review in a very narrow sense versus the American sense, which is very broad, you have really no huge intellectual debate over what in the United States is a very big debate for conservatives. And that's called the counter-majoritarian problem of judicial review. Because surprisingly, your constitutional courts have worked really very well in the last 50 years, unlike the continuing controversy over the Supreme Court and judicial review in the United States. And the counter-majoritarian problem is simply, and this is something that all conservatives, if you want to march to a conservative flag, that's all you have to say, and you'll get a big band, a crowd following you. I hate judicial review. Because judicial review is used to strike down democratically enacted laws. So it's counter-majoritarian. So there's a certain intellectual link to Edmund Burke. I said I wouldn't talk about him. But there is a certain intellectual link that conservatives share with Edmund Burke in that they tend to be Anglophiles. Because there was no judicial review in England until quite recently, until 5 years ago, really. And Blair's proposal to establish a Supreme Court. So there's a deep distrust of, for example, a year ago, one of the most controversial but most important intellectual thinkers in the conservative movement in law, Judge Robert Bork, who was defeated for an appointment to the Supreme Court in 1987, published a book called The Worldwide Rule of Judges. And he attacked the Supreme Court, of course, for these abortion decisions and homelessness. And he attacked, he said, oh, once Canada in 1988 adopted the Charter of Rights, we knew we were in trouble because judges would have to interpret the Charter of Rights. And then look what the ECJ has done. And the Hungarian Supreme Court struck down the death penalty of all things. Worldwide rule of judges. He says, problem is judges are part of the intellectual elite. What does that mean? They base their decisions on reason. He says, anybody that uses signs and symbols is an intellectual and part of the intellectual elite. I haven't seen anything that radical said since Pol Pot. And you know what Pol Pot did in Cambodia in the 70s? They killed everybody who was an intellectual or spoke an English or a foreign language. So this is the depth of conservatism with regard to the judiciary. I mean, we don't like judges. Now, the interesting thing is this phrase, and it stems from counter-majoritarianism, this phrase judicial activism in politics versus judicial self-restraint. What do those terms mean? Well, judicial activism was a phrase invented by liberals in the 1920s and 30s to attack the conservative court for striking down progressive legislation and the New Deal. Oh, women. We should restrict the number of hours women work. Child labor, liberals were saying. We should limit the number of hours. A young lady like you shouldn't have to work more than 60 hours in a 7-day week. And the conservative court was striking down those policies. So liberals attack judicial activism, attack judicial conservatism. But after Brown versus Board of Education and Roe versus Wade, conservatives co-opted that term. And they have attacked for the last 50 years judicial activism, by which they mean judicial liberalism or legal liberalism. So it's very important to keep those terms in mind. So I've laid out the five principal tenets of what I consider to be conservatism. Now let me talk about the last 25 years and how I think there's been a contradiction of those principles, that there's been a turning back on those principles. The first principle that I mentioned was philosophical skepticism, epistemological doubt, a distrust of reason. But what have we had in the last 25 years with a vengeance in the United States from Ronald Reagan to King George III? I have to keep stop saying that. But it's so fitting, given his war in Iraq and his claims of presidential power, we haven't had any president claim unbridled power since King George III. I mean, to claim that you can keep indefinitely, incommunicado, without judicial review, enemy combatants in Guantanamo Bay is an extraordinary claim of presidential power. It runs against the very grain of the rule of law and judicial review. So that's why I keep referring to him subconsciously as King George III, because it was absolutely an unbelievable claim of presidential power, which even the conservative Supreme Court rejected and said, you know, these poor individuals have a right to at least have a hearing before an independent tribunal. Anyway, you've got me on I got myself on a digression, excuse me. But to go back, the first point was, traditional conservatives believed in philosophical skepticism, but over the last 25 years has been a profound rise in fundamentalism, specifically Christian fundamentalism. There is no doubt, there is moral certainty about our beliefs. That runs against traditional, I think, in the culture, traditional conservatism, who believed in tradition, who believed in faith, but did not have the kind of moral certainty that the evangelical, the so-called new Christian right, which was central to Ronald Reagan's winning coalition in 1980 and 84, and certainly part of Bush's elections in 2000 and 2004, not to mention the new Christian right's war over 8 years against Bill Clinton. I'm not going to defend him. And I don't think he needs much defense in France, but but they were wanted to impeach him before he was inaugurated. Not to mention then how they dogged him throughout his 8 years in office. Nor need I say this fundamentalism in President George W. Bush's dogged certitude about foreign policy and his persistence, about which I'll say more in a moment. So the rise of fundamentalism is a contradiction to traditional conservatism. The second point is that government has not shrunk, but has expanded in the last 25 years, contrary to traditional conservatism, which believed in limited government. Most notably, of course, was the creation of the Department of Homeland Security. Now, to be sure, after 9/11, there had to be a national and international response to the tragedy that took place in New York and Washington, D.C. But in the creation of this new department, the government has overridden the first responders to national emergencies, state and local government, without funding them, and hence intruded upon or eroded traditional principle of federalism. So, ironically, instead of limited government, we get expanded government under this so-called new conservatism of the Bush administration. Not unrelated, of course, to show you how much this has changed, is that in 1980, Ronald Reagan called for the abolition of the Department of Education. We don't need national standards. What does President Bush run as a platform figure in 2000? I'm going to be the education president. And he pushes for what? Establishing national standards in primary and secondary schools with his No Child Left Behind law. Another clear erosion of federalism, another clear repudiation of the traditional tenets of conservatism. Well, let me bring you to the third point, or paradox, which is the easiest one to see. And instead of financial restraint, and after the years of balanced budgets during the Clinton administration, we've run up enormous budgetary and trade deficits. I can speak with authority on this because I had to buy euros. And I see how the dollar is plummeting over the last 10 years. Well, that's the result of our budget and trade deficits. It's very painful for me, so I'm almost a conservative now, a traditional conservative. Fourth, in spite of the traditional conservative's position in foreign affairs, emphasizing isolationism, non-interventionism, a position which actually, again, Bush in 2000 was elected as the education president, but thought, nation building, that's too liberal, that's ridiculous, that's the Marshall Plan, that's liberalism, I'm not gonna do this. Well, what has Bush done? He's embarked on a misadventure with his neocon advisors and advanced the position of preventive wars, exporting democracy, and engaging in nation building in Iraq and the Middle East and elsewhere. Now, well, I'll say what I think about that, but leave it to say that that is a neocon position that is certainly contrary to the traditional conservative position of isolationism and non-intervention. Fifth and finally, in spite of the fifth paradox, In spite of the fact that each Republican president in the last 35 years campaigned on themes of law and order, strict constructionism, a jurisprudence of original intent, and self-restraint, as well as in the last 35 years appointed 11 out of the 13 appointees to the Supreme Court. Our Supreme Court only has 9 members, but Republicans have appointed 11 of those members out of the 13. Clinton had 2 appointees. He's the only Democrat in the last 35 years to make any appointees. We've seen only a modest conservative trend in the areas of criminal justice, in the areas of federalism and limiting congressional powers, and affirming more governmental aid to religion. On the other hand, successive conservative courts handed down Roe versus Wade and refused to overturn that decision, much to the ire of the new Christian right. In addition, the court has become a more conservative court, has become even a stauncher defender of freedom of speech, especially on the internet, which is contrary to cultural conservatives' position, namely that we should limit. The court even 2 years ago struck down a federal law, a congressional law, which had made it a crime to put on the internet virtual child pornography. I had to go and read the case, because what is virtual child pornography? It's where you take a picture of a woman nude and then superimpose a child's heads on it, or you simulate it through computer animation. This apparently appeals very much to pedophiles. So there are lots of reasons for not only conservatives, but liberals to say, wait a minute, you know, maybe we should ban virtual child pornography, because it's unlike actual child pornography, where a child is involved and hence harmed in its production. This is entirely artistic creation. And the Supreme Court struck it down, a conservative court, much to the ire of cultural conservatives, I would say. And then, of course, cultural conservatives, new rights, are no less disillusioned by the court striking down laws forbidding discrimination against homosexuals and criminalizing sodomy. Bush in 2004, despite the fact that he has no control over the appointment of state court judges, lambasted the Massachusetts Supreme Court for striking down, saying that you can't discriminate against same-sex marriages. He has no control over that, but that was big in politics in his campaign. So let me turn finally to the crisis of contemporary federalism. I think if there was any doubt, the November 2006 election underscore the crisis of contemporary Republican conservatism. Admittedly, presidents usually lose support in midterm elections in their second term, but Bush lost majorities and control of both the House of Representatives and the Senate. He's no longer just wounded, he's more than a lame duck for the next 2 years. I don't know what you can be more than a lame duck, but I haven't thought of a metaphor yet, but I'll think about it tonight, probably it'll come to me. I used to say he was wounded, but now he's almost a dead duck, I guess, would be the thing to say. So, the 2006 elections. Then, of course, there was the misadventure in the war in Iraq, which was, of course, a major figure factor in the 2006 elections. Notably, a bipartisan study commission's report released after the election repudiated Bush's conduct in the war. No more stay the course was its main message. Now we find, again, the fundamentalism in King George III. He says, I won't release a response to this report until after the new year, until 2007. And now his supporters are saying, we're not going to just stay the course. We may up the ante by actually increasing the number of troops in Iraq. I think that's going to exacerbate the crisis of contemporary conservatism. In addition, Christian conservatives, the so-called new Christian right, and what led to the defeat, I think, in 2006, were simply not as mobilized as in 2000 or 2004 elections, because they too are disillusioned with neocon foreign policy, with the staggering budget and trade deficits, and with the continued growth of government under the Bush administration. I found yesterday the Gallup poll released a public opinion poll of the United States and their evaluation of President Bush relative to the last five presidents. 4% found him outstanding. 4%. 15% said, he's above average. I could go along with that comparing Nixon, I suppose. 27% said he's an average president. 25% said he's below average. And 29% said he's poor. So that means 71% of the American people think that Bush is at best somewhere between average and poor. 71%. What does that say about conservatism and the culture of conservatism and the policies that this administration has taken us in? Is conservatism any longer cultural conservatism, at least with this administration? In conclusion, the fundamentalism of contemporary conservatism is being called into question by traditional conservatives and underscores, I think, the crisis of contemporary conservatism. There have been several books published this year criticizing conservatism. One, of course, is the U.S. pundit Andrew Sullivan's The Conservative Soul. But more telling, I think, and more important, is a book by John Danforth. Danforth is a longtime conservative, was a former senator from Missouri, was the primary sponsor of Clarence Thomas to the Supreme Court, and primary defender of Clarence Thomas, who was Bush 1's, not to confuse Bush 1, because I've talked about Bush 3, but George H.W. Bush, George H.W. Bush is appointee who was replaced Thurgood Marshall, who was the great metaphor for liberalism. Thurgood Marshall had argued Brown versus Board of Education, was a leader of the civil rights movement, and when he stepped down in 1991, he really was a metaphor for the Great Society, for the civil rights movement, for what the national government has done to advance the rights of women and minorities in the United States. Clarence Thomas, by contrast, was a metaphor for the up-by-your-bootstraps, trickle-down economic philosophy of contemporary conservatism. He grew up in Pinpoint, Georgia, worked his way through college, never talked about Roe versus Wade when he was at Yale Law School, surprisingly. But he worked for, as a young man, John Danforth when he was governor of Missouri, and was promoted through the ranks. So Danforth then was appointed by George W. Bush to be ambassador to the United Nations, where he worked for about a year and a half. Danforth's book, which came out this year, I think underscores the crisis of contemporary conservatism in the very title of itself. And the title is Faith and Politics: How Moral Values Debate Divides America. And I think that's the crisis and will lead to a reconsideration of contemporary conservatism. With that, I will turn it over to not Irving Kristol, but